Welcome to Trial Lawyer Talk. This is Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we talk with some of the best trial lawyers in the country. Today, we're very fortunate to have with us a phenomenal trial lawyer who focuses on military criminal defense as well as civil criminal law, based, frankly, all over the country, although he's now practicing primarily out of San Diego, Phil Stackhouse. Phil is a wonderful, creative, devoted, and dedicated trial lawyer, and we've got a lot to learn from Phil. He's going to share with us the story of defending a soldier who's accused of murder. And let's get started. We are very lucky to have with us today Phil Stackhouse, who's a phenomenal lawyer who focuses on military criminal defense and non-military regular criminal defense, as well as personal injury work in cases all around the United States. Phil, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott. It's really cool.
Phil, can you share with us a case that had a profound impact on you?
I think the case that comes to mind for me is my client, David, and it's been a little while now. I guess it's been about 5 years, and David was accused of killing somebody in Afghanistan, and not in a combat operation, but he was charged both with involuntary manslaughter. They attempted to add a charge of murder for the conduct, and he was also charged with negligent homicide. And the allegations took place in Afghanistan, and the preliminary inquiry, or the military equivalent of a grand jury investigation, took place in Afghanistan, and the trial itself actually took place in Afghanistan as well. And it's probably, you know, if not the case that had the most impact on me, it's one of the most, or one of the cases that had the most impact on me, for sure.
Great. Tell us about the story of the case.
Well, generally speaking, the allegations were David was on guard duty at a combat outpost in Afghanistan, and he was on duty with another soldier. And the allegation was is that he picked up his weapon, aimed it at an individual that was walking down a dirt road several hundred meters away from his guard post, sighted in on him, and pulled the trigger.
So essentially just killed him?
Just killed him indiscriminately. Worst case scenario from the government's perspective, probably from our perspective, the best case scenario, the allegation was he aimed at the individual, pulled the trigger, but didn't know that there was a round in his weapon. So was acting with disregard to the reasonably foreseeable consequences of his conduct. And David was a fantastic soldier, was on his third combat tour, very well respected in his unit, and just, I mean, he's a great man, and still is. I mean, he and I are friends, you know, today, still today. Comes from a great family. His dad was a Navy officer, surgeon, just a great family, great kid. And his father contacted me in Washington, D.C., asked me if I would represent his son. I told him that I needed to talk to David first to make sure that he and I got along well, and that was going to be on the phone to begin with, and it was going to be on the phone until I could travel to Afghanistan to meet him for the first time. So what happened is you know, these charges came down. I bought a plane ticket from Washington, D.C. to Afghanistan via Dubai, and we, I say we, it was me, I flew out from Dubai. We get on a contract 727, fly from Dubai over Bagram Air Base, and I think you fly into Bagram Air Base at like 30,000 feet, and then the jet kind of goes into a, you know, 30 or 40 degree bank, and then just spirals down from, you know, 20 or 30,000 feet to the airstrip at Bagram Air Base to avoid anti-aircraft fire being zeroed in on the aircraft. It was me and a bunch of civilian contractors landing at Bagram Air Base, and they have a little customs immigration type facility there at Bagram that you had to go through, and you had to have a Afghan visa in your passport. And so I did that and met David, and it was a you know, it was an interesting situation, to say the very least, showing up in Afghanistan to represent somebody I'd never met before.
So what happened when you met David?
Well, David and I had spent quite a bit of time on the phone talking about just things, not really about the case, but just me getting to know him, what his family life was like when he was growing up, what high school was like for him. He enlisted in the Army right after high school, so, I mean, that was kind of his civilian life, was being raised by a family and going to high schools, you know, the things that he remembered. We talked about his military service up to that point. He had been in for a little over 4 years, had been stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and had moved to Italy and was stationed in Italy and deployed to Afghanistan from Italy as an infantryman. So we spent a lot of time on the phone talking about that. When we got to Afghanistan, it was during the day. It was a real treat for me because there was a Army Trial Defense Council or Army Trial Defense Service office at Bagram Air Base. So there were Army attorneys there. We had office spaces that were in kind of this rundown, kind of rundown utility type building. They introduced me to David's military attorney, the Army captain that had been working with him. And he and I went to where I was going to be billeted for the few days that I was going to be there. And
what does that mean?
It's where I was going to sleep. So it's, and it was basically a woodshed. With a couple other Army officers that were housed there for their entire one-year tour in Afghanistan. I was only going to be there for a few days. So after I met the Army attorney, we had David come over to the Trial Defense Service office and, you know, got to meet each other for the first time. And again, just spent some time talking about, you know, him and, you know, introducing him to me and, you know, what my life is like and the things that I've done. So we got to know each other pretty well and got to know a little bit about each other's background.
What did you share with him about your life?
Well, one of the things for me, when especially when I'm representing an enlisted service member, is just to let them know that I've been there. I was an enlisted guy in the Marines for 9 years. So I let them know that while we might have had different jobs or served in different places, that I've been in the position that they've been in and kind of came up through the ranks like they came up through the ranks. And it allows us to bond a little bit quicker because, true or not, I think people assume that we've shared some of the same experiences. And I think by and large that's true, that we had shared a lot of the same experiences. But it lets you make that jump a little bit quicker.
Did you share with him any of your fears that you had when you were in the military?
I did. One of the things for me is I was an enlisted guy for, like I said, about 9 years. And after I got commissioned, before I became a lawyer, I was an infantry officer. So it also allowed us to bond pretty quick as well. But for me, when I was an enlisted guy and when I was an infantry officer, it was before the war on terror had begun, before 9/11 took place. So my experiences as an enlisted Marine, my experiences as an infantry officer were in peacetime, preparing for combat operations, but not engaging in combat operations. So one of the things I shared with him that was an ongoing joke was how, you know, I had finished 22 years and retired, and it was another 5 years after I retired, before I deployed to a combat zone, when, you know, most of the guys are on active duty, you know, itching to go into a combat zone. So, you know, we had a pretty good time talking about that. And I think we got to know each other pretty quick, pretty quick.
So what happened next?
So the next thing that takes place is we went to a forward operating base called Shank, and we took helicopters to Shank. So we were in these combat transport helicopters, and it was probably, by the time we were all done, it was probably a 5 or 6 hour helicopter ride, because a very circuitous route that we took, because we were just kind of jumping on flights as we could jump on them to get to where we needed to be.
So you would jump on a military flight to get someplace and then try to get from there to your destination?
Yeah, it's kind of a leapfrog kind of a thing. So it took us some time to get there, but we ended up getting to Forward Operating Base Shank. And once we got there, we did what ended up being a couple-day hearing into the allegations. Unlike a grand jury investigation in the civilian community, in the military, the grand jury equivalent called an Article 32, the accused gets to be there. So we actually had the opportunity to be at the hearing. We got to cross-examine witnesses. We got to see a little bit about what evidence the government had against David. And that's where they asked the investigating officer to add a charge of murder onto the charge sheet. Ultimately, we were able to defeat that request. But at the end of the day, they, what's called referred, they ended up referring charges of involuntary manslaughter, or manslaughter, I should say, and negligent homicide to trial. So that hearing took place. I flew back to the States, and probably a week or two later, we found out that the charges were going forward with manslaughter and negligent homicide. So the next step was to begin the process of preparing for trial, which we knew was going to happen in Afghanistan. It was after that pretrial investigation, I ended up going to Trial Lawyers College and learned some very cutting-edge techniques in representing clients. And probably a month or so after I graduated from Trial Lawyers College, I flew to Afghanistan for the trial.
So tell me what happened when you flew to Afghanistan.
It was kind of the same run-through on getting there. It was from D.C. to Dubai and then corkscrewing in to Bagram. The difference this time was it wasn't just going to be me that was going to be there. David's mom and dad flew to Afghanistan as well. They showed up a day or two after I got there, but it was going to be in it's a much nicer building than the office spaces that we were working out of or that the pretrial investigation took place in. It was a very nicely apportioned building. The courtroom was large. There was an opportunity for there to be witnesses to the trial, not witnesses in the trial, but there was an audience could be there and watch what was going to take place. So David's mother and father came to Afghanistan to watch what was going to happen. And I think it was one of the first times I had a client's mom and dad actually come to see what was going to take place during the trial. So that was some added added pressure, I guess, for lack of a better term. And we had spent a lot of time working with David during the pretrial investigation phase. Now several months had gone by, and one of the things that was really hard was that David had become very cold to what happened. When I first met him, he was very remorseful for what happened. He had written a letter of apology to the family of the man that had died. It turns out that the man was a doctor that was walking to a well, and David was doing some quick reaction drills with his weapon in the guard tower, and had inadvertently left a round in his weapon, wasn't even aiming in at anything. He literally had a negligent discharge of his weapon. And the after that happened, you know, he had taken time to write an apology letter to the family. When someone is hurt or property is damaged in a combat zone, the military can and does make these payments to the family called salacia payments. where they can essentially try to make the injured party whole for what happened to them at the hands of the military. And that was going to happen in this case to the family of the man that had died. And David tried to make that payment himself and not have the government have to make the payment. He wanted to talk to the man's family, to apologize personally to them. That's who he was. And when we came back several months later for the trial, he had become very cold and was almost shit happens in a time of war. And that's not who he was a few months earlier. And we spent some time talking about what I absolutely saw as this being a defense mechanism that he had taken on to deal with the guilt that he felt for what had happened, the pain that he had felt about what happened, and still having to be in Afghanistan while he was removed from his unit. He was still in Afghanistan. He wasn't home dealing with, you know, regular day-to-day matters, and it was a defense mechanism that he had put up. So when I got to Afghanistan and we had seen that this change had occurred, we worked very, very hard on getting him back to where he had originally felt after the accident had happened. And we spent an entire day working on that.
How?
Well, it's a little hard to describe, on the microphone, but I'll do my best. We spent time with, David, my co-counsel, who was an Army captain, a paralegal who, just by circumstance, happened to be an active duty Marine assigned to the Army legal office. We spent time with David doing reenactments about what had happened on that day, trying to get him back in touch with, and in fact getting him back in touch with, the emotions that he had felt once he realized what had happened. We did some things called encounters where we had David reverse roles with the man who was killed and take on those kind of feelings and again reverse roles back into his own feelings and emotions. We spent some time looking at the pictures from the scene. We spent time talking to some of the huge supporters that he had there in his unit that connected with the feelings of remorse and guilt that he had felt after it had happened, that he had accidentally taken somebody's life and had them share their feelings about David and how he had responded when the accident had originally occurred, how remorseful he was, how sorry he was, how concerned he was, not just for the person who had been shot, but for how that person's family was going to be provided for after, one of the elders of the family had been taken. And all of those things allowed David to get back in touch with those emotions that he had originally felt, that he was able to shed that defense mechanism that he had put up, and that I think we would all have at some point.
So then what happened?
So his mom and dad came, like I said, a couple days later. We continued doing witness interviews, another person that was in the guard tower with David when this happened. We spent some time with him, having him go through some reenactments about what he observed during the day with some of David's soldiers that were around him at the time, not in the tower, but around him, and saw what had happened afterwards. Did some reenactments with them to really take us through what took place. How were people feeling? I mean, what was the energy around the combat outpost when that happened? How did it affect everyone? And we worked on those types of things for about a week, and then the trial began. And the next thing that really had to be decided was, first, is David going to testify? And we always felt that he did, and he committed to testifying. And then the next thing was he going to fully embrace what had happened and accept responsibility, and whatever the results of the trial were, those were going to be the results. And that was his decision as well, and he did. So We went into the trial knowing that he was going to testify, knowing he was going to embrace what had happened, all of the remorse, all of the guilt, all of the actions. He was going to embrace everything. Once we decided that that was going to be the case, it made it a much easier, I shouldn't say easier, it made a much clearer path for us on how we were going to take the trial to the jury. And so the next piece was selecting the right jury. It's a tough, you know, it's a tough area to select a jury. In the military, it's not a random grouping of people brought from the local community to sit as a jury. And the military, the commanding general who has made the decision to send the soldier to trial, hand selects the jury veneer. And so we know that the officers and the enlisted soldiers that are going to sit as jurors have had their backgrounds screened by a commanding general, that he has, among other things, selected those individuals he felt had the best experience, the best leadership traits, the best judicial temperament, would be the most objective group of individuals that he had available to him. All of that sounds great, but they're also a group of jurors you're never going to be able or rarely be able to pull the wool over their eyes. These are people that are highly educated, highly experienced. I think the jury that we had, almost everyone had a college degree. They almost all had, or they certainly all had, more than 15 years of professional experience. Some of them had well over 20 years of professional experience. So it was a experienced, well-educated jury that we were going to be dealing with. And so getting the right jurors out of that veneer was a very important aspect.
So how did you do that?
One of the benefits of this trial is we had a very good trial judge who let us try the case however we wanted to try it. There were at times he was paternalistic, but he was paternalistic in making sure that David was protected. I'll talk about that in a minute, but essentially he let us try the case that we wanted to try, and so we had some fears in the case. You know, the fact that somebody had died and David did it, and we were going to let them know that David did it. And how they were going to respond to that. There was going to be pictures. And the pictures, you know, we can say everybody's a battle-hardened, you know, soldier, veteran of multiple combat operations. But, you know, when you're looking at pictures of someone who's been shot, there are very visceral reactions that come from that. And we were going to have to deal with those evidentiary photos that were going to be coming into evidence. It was said to us that the family members of the man who was shot were going to be flown in for the trial, so there was going to be some real emotion that was going to be evoked during the conduct of the trial, and how people respond to those types of emotions vary. And so what we did is, and quite frankly, how it was going to affect us, and how it was going to affect us in dealing with those witnesses. And so what we did is we shared those fears that we had with the jury and asked them for their thoughts, their feelings about those same fears. And it allowed us to engage in a real conversation with a group of, I think we started out with 12, maybe there was 10, that we started out with, and it allowed us to have a real conversation about those fears and how they thought it might affect them, what their feelings were about the things that we shared with them. So, like I said, the judge allowed us to really try the case that we wanted to. He didn't get in the way of us having discussions with the jurors to see if they were going to be able to put aside those emotions, or if they were going to be able to, you know, make decisions in spite of those emotions and those feelings that they had. And there were a couple who didn't think they were going to be able to. And we tried to, and in fact did, create an environment in the courtroom that they were comfortable sharing that with us. And we, I think we excused a couple because of their concerns that they might not be able to be fair. And it was a good jury selection process, a good voir dire, because it wasn't us excluding somebody from the jury. It was a couple of the jurors, they call them members in a court martial, but a couple of the jurors saying that they weren't sure they could be fair and asked to be excused from the jury. So it allowed us to keep a jury intact that all communicated well with us and that we had all bonded with during the selection process.
What happened after that?
After we had the jury selected, we began opening statements. And based upon the work that we had done with David and the decisions that we had made during the opening statements, we told the jury exactly what happened. We told them that David had come back from, sleep. He had the night off. Not like he was going out on liberty or anything, but he didn't have to work that the night before, that he had gotten up at about 5:30 in the morning, grabbed breakfast for him and his soldier that was going to be on guard duty with him, put it in sort of a to-go box and brought it to the guard tower. And we set the scene of the guard tower right in the middle of the courtroom. We didn't have the ability to build one, but we kind of mapped out the 10x10 size of the room, and we oriented the jury to everything that was inside that guard room. And really, I was able to take the jury all the way through it, reversing roles with my client during the opening statement and speaking in the first person, telling his story to the jury, the story that he was going to tell from the witness stand. And we committed that to the jury. We said, look, you're going to hear from David because he's going to take the stand. And he's going to tell you, I got up that morning at about 5:30 and got dressed, shaved, and went to the chow hall and told the story just like that. We told the story about how he had picked his weapon up and unloaded it and did some quick reaction drills that he was trained in and that he trained other people in with these presentation drills of a weapon, that he had put the magazine back into the gun, set it in the corner, talked to his soldier there for a little while. They joked around a little bit, had a little bit to eat, and he picked the weapon up again, started doing the same reaction drills, and he didn't take the magazine out before he pulled the trigger. And so he had actually racked around into the chamber and pulled the trigger, and the bullet went wherever it was going to go, whatever direction the weapon was pointed. And unfortunately, it passed through the window of the guard tower and traveled, a few hundred meters from the guard tower and hit somebody that was innocently walking down the road and killed him.
At that moment, when you told that to the jury, essentially that your client killed him, what was going on inside of you?
Well, it's the first time I had ever done anything like that, that I can remember anyway, where I was essentially saying, look, my client killed somebody and it was an accident, but there's no way to sugarcoat it. He had the round in the magazine, he put the round in the chamber, he took the weapon off safe, he put his finger in the trigger well, he depressed the trigger and a bullet exited his weapon and hit somebody and killed him. I can tell you, when we were preparing that opening statement, it was really hard to say, and I had probably more fear in saying that to a jury the first time than, at least in the courtroom, that I had ever had before. And the jury, they were pretty stoic, so there wasn't a lot of emotion on their faces. So I didn't know if it was resonating with them or if they were just like, you just screwed your client, or if they were, wow, this is horrible about what happened to him, because they were very poker-faced. And when I was talking about the judge being paternalistic after the close or after the opening statement, he excused the jury for a little while and on the record started to almost chastise us by admitting our client had, you know, committed, if not manslaughter, involuntary or a negligent homicide. And what were we doing? And why, you know, why would we admit that our client did that? And wanted to talk to our client about whether or not he agreed with the strategy that we had developed in the case, which he, you know, said that he did because we had, you know, spent days working on it. But it was not the direction certainly that the court thought we were going to go. And ultimately, I don't think it's the direction that I thought the prosecutor thought we were going to go either.
Yep. I don't think many prosecutors are used to having defense attorneys essentially acknowledge that their client did what they're being accused of doing.
Right. I think that's exactly right. And so the, you know, the government, you know, put on their witnesses. They put on, you know, the witnesses, that the soldier that was in the guard tower, they put on some doctors that had treated the man who was killed. They put on some of David's leadership and soldiers that he had admitted responsibility for shooting the gun and that he had expressed remorse, you know, sort of all of these things to show that essentially what we had already admitted, you know, took place. But they put on all of those witnesses and they rested their case. And I think that they put their case on over a couple of days. And so I think the third day of trial, we began our case by putting David on, and he was our first witness. And David, through the questions that I was asking, the judge allowed him to get out of the witness box and be in the well of the courtroom. And he described and set up and oriented the jury to the exact same guard room or guard house that I had in the opening statements. And he truthfully and emotionally told his story. And I think one of the most telling and probably the biggest turning point of the trial was during David's testimony, when we got to the point where he had picked his gun up for the second time and was going to engage in some of these quick reaction drills again. He gets to the point where he's picked up the gun and he's getting ready to lift it, not up to his shoulder, but lift it up like he would present it in one of these quick reaction drills, and he can't lift it up. And he doesn't have a gun in his hand. He's just kind of using his, you know, pretending like he had a gun in his hand, but he can't lift his arms up to present what would be the gun, because this time he knows what's going to happen. And he is really in the moment. He's put himself back on that day when the accident happened. He's living it in the courtroom just like he lived it on that day, except he knows what's going to happen. And as he's to the point where he would present the weapon, he has tears coming down his cheek, his, you know, his chin is quivering, and he's not responding to my question about show us what happens next. And we were able to, you know, I'm back away from him a little ways, and I'm able to look over into the jury box, and several of the jurors have tears coming down their cheek because they know what's getting ready to happen too, and they can see the emotional struggle that David's having right now. And so I think it's right there at that point, at that time, that the jurors fully and completely bonded with David. They know what happened. They know that he didn't do anything on purpose. They know that this was a terrible accident. And, you know, and we continued on with the testimony with some prompting, and it took about, I think, 6 hours for David to finish his testimony that day. So it was a super hard day. I think it was somewhat cathartic for David to be able to give his story in the courtroom. I think it was, you know, one of the most powerful things that I've seen ever happen in the courtroom, what he did that day.
What's next in the story?
There were a couple more witnesses that we called during the trial. And and then we closed, and then we rested. So we took some time to work on jury instructions with the judge, and we came in and argued the next morning. And the arguments, for the most part for us, were very similar to the opening statements. We retold David's story, not the story of the case, but the story of the trial, which for us was somewhat similar because David told that story in the well of the courtroom. So we didn't reenact everything again, important pieces of it. We respected the scene that we had set in the courtroom so that that was always, that well in the courtroom was always going to be the guard tower, and that's the way we addressed it. That's the way that we dealt with it. And it was a good closing argument because I got a lot of favorable nods from the jurors. They were very engaged, not personally, but they were engaged emotionally. I mean, you could see it in their eyes. You could see it in their facial expressions. You could see it in their nods, their shakes. So it was a good closing argument. And it's one of those days for me that, you know, when you feel like you're in the zone, you know, when you're in flow, and that's the way that I remember it. The jury closed for deliberate, and they had been deliberating for hours, and they came back with a question. And the question that they asked to the court was, if we believe that this was an accident, do we have to find him guilty? And we spent the next hour or so arguing with the judge that if he went back with the jury and told them that the answer was yes, that even if it was an accident, if it met the elements, they would have to find him guilty. Our concern was with the instruction for negligent homicide, including the absence of due care, that if the judge went back and said yes, you would still have to find him guilty. We didn't know if they were asking about negligent homicide or voluntary manslaughter and how that worked, that they would convict him of manslaughter. What ended up happening is not long after the judge essentially just reread the negligent homicide instruction to the jury, they came back probably 20 minutes later and convicted him of negligent homicide. And that was hard. I mean, it was...
What did the judge say in response to that juror question?
So the judge essentially went back and said, well, I can't define what an accident is to you. If you believe that there was the absence of due care, essentially, yes, you had to find him guilty. Our concern was we didn't know if they were asking about manslaughter or negligent homicide. So when they came back with a conviction of negligent homicide, we were disappointed because there's an additional element in a military case. It's not just a death resulting from the absence of due care. His conduct had to be prejudicial to good order and discipline or service discrediting, and that was our entire case. What happened happened, but it wasn't service discrediting and it wasn't prejudicial to the good order and discipline of his unit. Regardless, they came back and convicted him, and then probably the most powerful thing that I've ever seen as a lawyer happened when we learned that they were going to bring the person who died, they were going to bring his son and his brother in to testify at sentencing. They came in early that morning and we were given the opportunity to interview them. They didn't speak English, so there was a translator that was there as well. And my Army counsel and I went in to talk to them, and there wasn't really anything that we needed to interview them about. We talked to them about, expressed our apologies for the loss of their father and their brother. But, you know, it rings very hollow. I'm just an attorney, you know, and I'm an American attorney at that. But one of the things that we asked them at the request of David is if they'd be willing to meet with David. And they said that they would. And so we went and got him and we brought David into the room with them. And you could tell that they were angry, but you could also see in David through the tears that were coming down his cheek. You could see it in his eyes. You could see it on his face, how sorry he was and how how remorseful he was, and this was his opportunity to be able to look them in the eye and tell them that it was his fault and that he is sorry for what happened. And it was super emotional. It was a time when it had to have taken incredible courage to, you know, come face to face with the family of the person that you killed to be able to tell them that you were sorry. We spent probably 20 minutes with the family and went back into the courtroom. The prosecutors presented the uncle or the brother and presented the son as witnesses. We didn't ask any questions for them. We just acknowledged their loss from David. And the prosecutors rested, and David took the stand to testify at his own sentencing case. And, you know, he talked about the how much he enjoyed his career up to that point, his serving with Soldiers in Combat, how badly he still wanted to be able to serve in the Army in any capacity that they would allow him, and that's what he asked for the jury to do for him. The prosecutor, during cross-examination, had seen David come out of that room, but he, you know, he came in and he said, you know, you killed this individual, you know, you took a father away from a son, you took a brother away from a brother, you did all of these things, you did it in your, you know, by your hand, by your negligence, you did all of this, isn't that true? And then he said, and you actually talked to the son and the brother, didn't you? And that was a private conversation. It didn't have anything to do with the trial, but the prosecutors made it part of the trial. So I was able to stand up on my redirect examination of David and ask him about that and ask him about the meeting that he had. And I said, you know, this was a private meeting, but since the prosecutors have brought it up, tell the jury about the meeting if you would. And, you know, David said, you know, words to the effect of, what happens to me during this trial, it doesn't matter at this point because I've gotten everything that I ever wanted, which was to be able to apologize by looking them, his family, in the eyes and apologize for what I had done. And I'm at peace with that now. So we had the opportunity to put on a couple witnesses after that, after David testified, that described examples of David's conduct in combat operations during other deployments and the awards for valor that he had received while fighting against the enemy. And then both of us had the opportunity, both sides had the opportunity to argue. And this was one of the, one of these, fast heart, heavy, heavy beat times. You know, the jury closed for deliberations on the sentence, and they had been deliberating for about 2 hours, and our flight was leaving in an hour to leave the States. And I was flying back with David's mom and dad, and our paralegal had gone to what's essentially a shipping container turned into an office that was the flight line for the jet taking off. They gave him our boarding passes, which were literally playing cards. That was our boarding pass. And we had everything ready to go. Just, you know, we could be from the courthouse on the plane in 15 minutes. And the jury came back with a sentence about 30 minutes before the flight was going to leave. And they came back and they gave David a punishment that included the reduction in rank by 2 ranks. And they put him on some restriction for, I think, 45 days. And so he didn't go to jail for a day. He didn't get discharged from the Army. And when the jury went back to the deliberation room to get their, you know, their personal belongings, when they exited the jury room, they walked between a group of people that included David on one side and his mom and dad on the other side. And they had to kind of walk between us you know, each of the jurors patted him on the arm or thumped him on the chest and told him it was going to be okay. He was going to be okay. And seeing that care from those jurors after, you know, hearing what had happened and actually looking, you know, into David's eyes as he told the story, I mean, that really, truly allowed me to know that we had really connected with that jury, that our story resonated with them, that they connected with David, that at some point during that trial they had put themselves in David's place, and that he acted the way that they would have acted, and that they did for him what they would have wanted a jury to do for them if they had engaged in, you know, that kind of act as well. So it was super powerful.
So how did that case and result impact Phil Stackhouse?
Well, it was huge in a bunch of different reasons. I mean, like the quickest impact was I was going to be on a plane for the next, you know, 14 hours with David's mom and dad. So it was a really good thing that we got a good result, because it made the trip back to the States much more comfortable. But what it did for me is it really showed me that when you have a deep caring for your client and not a superficial care as a lawyer representing a person, but when you really care for your client, when you can stand in front of a jury and speak from the heart, when you believe to your core the story that you're telling about your client, and you believe to your core your client, that you know, those beliefs they connect with a jury, and it allows the jury to connect to those feelings. And when you can build that type of connection through story with a jury, they will do the right thing. Now, that right thing might not be what you always want at the end of the day, but if you're able to build those connections and you're speaking from the heart and you're speaking with emotion, that it will allow the jury to do the right thing. I think the other thing that it did for me is it gave me a deep belief that the methods that I learned at Trial Lawyers College and through my mentors is super effective, because it's real. And it's not a gimmick. It's not a game. It's not acting. It's, it's telling a story of real life. And I think that's how it's affected me professionally anyway.
This is an amazing story of a wonderful victory. Can you share with us how it feels to lose?
I can, and it's, it's another case out of Afghanistan, and my client Cal was charged with three murders and a host of other crimes, all originating out of Afghanistan, that included aggravated assaults. It included, mutilating dead bodies. They accused him of sort of leading this group of soldiers as part of what they characterized as a kill team. And it was, it was ridiculous, but that was what the government alleged. That's what had gotten into the press. That's what had, that's the aura that had surrounded the allegations and the trials that that preceded Cal's. I spent an enormous amount of time getting to know Cal. And when you would read in the press about how he was this ultra-violent, murdering marauder, gallivanting around Afghanistan, killing indiscriminately and, killing innocent Afghans, and you compare that to how I know him, which is, a loving husband, father of a two-year-old, who I spent a lot of time with as well, and spent time watching him interact with his son, Junior, coloring playing games, playing video games, taking pictures together, wrestling around on the floor in the, you know, the private office that we had while we were working on the case in Washington State. It was on a military base, and it was a military case, and they had brought him back for Afghanistan, but all of the allegations stem from Afghanistan. You know, I got to know him well, and you know, he became somebody very close to me and still is. I care about him more than I can tell you, his son, his you know, his entire family, and I'm still in touch with all of them. We put on a case in the face of government informants who had obtained very sweetheart deals to come in and plead guilty to murder of 1, 2, 3 people, and in exchange for getting decades of their life back, all they had to do was come in and say, Cal did it. It was Cal's fault. Cal started it. Cal was the leader. That's all they had to do. And they did, one after the other, told the same story. We worked with Cal for days, preparing him, because he too was going to testify, and it was going to be a case where he was going to admit to an enormous amount of misconduct. And he had to accept responsibility for that. And what he did not do, though, is he didn't murder anyone. He did a lot of other things that set him up to be an easy fall guy for some junior soldiers to point at. And that happened. And point away they did. You know, I think during his trial, he testified for 8 or 9 hours. Again, in the face of individuals who came in and admitted to an enormous amount of misconduct and just grouped him into it. And there was no proof other than their testimony. No proof other than their testimony. We, again, prepared him to testify. He got out of the witness box and drew maps for the jury. He got out of the witness box and reenacted things for the jury about how things took place.
He trusted you.
He trusted, yeah. I think he trusted us, and I think he still trusts us. His biggest disappointment in the entire process was the betrayal that he felt from soldiers and his own unit coming in and testifying against him in order to save themselves. And that sense of betrayal, it destroyed him, and the effects are visually and emotionally apparent today about the betrayal of these individuals coming in and lying. And again, he set himself up by engaging in conduct that was wrong, that was illegal, but he didn't commit any murders. But he put himself in a position where the allegations could be made.
How were those signs visually and emotionally apparent?
You can see it in his face. I mean, Cal's a huge guy. I mean, he's probably 6'4". He's probably, 225-230 pounds. He's an extremely powerful guy. And when these soldiers from his unit would come in and testify in the way that they did, I mean, you could see just the visceral anger sitting at the table next to him. You could see from where I was sitting, you could see that he was, clenching his jaw the entire time that they were testifying. When we would go back into our private rooms during recesses or overnight adjournments, you could just see he looked beat down, shoulders slumped over. It took a toll on him seeing these guys come in and say these things about him when he knew they weren't true. Even today, when we talk about it, those are the things that that affect him the most. We had spent time talking to him about if there was something that you could change, if you could go back before these allegations came up, what would you go back and do? And he said, if I could do anything, I would go back and I would wear a helmet camera the entire tour so that I could show that these guys are lying. I did what I did, but I didn't do what they're saying I did.
And that betrayal, like I said, I mean, it affects him today. It affects me through today.
How so?
Well, because, you know, when you see the toll that it takes on someone, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, he was convicted. He was convicted of the crimes that he was charged with. You know, he was sentenced to life with the eligibility for parole. So I'm still in contact with him. When I think back about this case and these guys coming in and just taking, liberty of the fact that there were no witnesses to what they're saying took place, so nobody can dispute it, nobody can prove it, nobody can disprove it, that they can come in and just indiscriminately say what they want to say, and a prosecutor is going to put them on the stand and embrace that. It tells me that the potential of anyone being convicted of a crime is always present, and these soldiers who should have a special bond with one another, especially soldiers that serve in combat should have with one another. And the fact that these soldiers came in, this handful of soldiers came in and betrayed that trust, betrayed that brotherhood. It's disappointing. It's exhausting. I don't know how to say it other than it has an effect.
Do you feel responsible for him being convicted? On some level.
Well, I mean, probably more than just some level. I mean, I think any case that I've had where my client was convicted, more so in the last, probably 5 or 6 years, because I get much closer to my clients than I used to, I feel an enormous responsibility. Had he been convicted of what he admitted to on the stand, I would be okay with that, and he would be okay with that. But when you pour your heart and soul into a case, you believe in your case because you believe in your client. There's evidence that supports exactly what your client has told you. Do I feel responsible for it? Yeah, I feel completely responsible for what happened. Do I feel like we connected with the jury anyway? I think the answer is yes. I mean, when they came back out and read the verdict, there was a woman that was the president of the court, or the equivalent of the foreman of the jury in a civilian jurisdiction, had tears in her eyes, coming out to read the verdict. So I know that we connected with them. They weren't angry. I think that they were sad about the situation. I'll never believe there wasn't something else that I could have done that would have resulted in a different verdict. So do I feel responsible? Yeah, I feel completely responsible for the result of what happened in that case. I feel, professionally responsible. I feel morally responsible for all my cases. There's more to the story in that we have discovered new evidence that wasn't available at the time of trial in Cal's case. I guess it's April 1st now, so last month, the beginning of last month, we went in and argued the first level of appeal in his case, and it is under advisement right now. I don't know what the appellate court is going to come back with, but the questioning that we received from the court was very favorable, and the questioning that fell upon the government was the type that put him in a very tough position to try to answer. So I feel good and hopeful that there'll be something that happens on appeal in that case. I don't know what the results will be, but I can tell you my fingers are crossed.
What do you think the public has no clue about when it comes to military prosecutions?
What they have no clue about, I think, one of the things that when I talk to civilian practitioners and just people in the general public is when I talked about this a little bit earlier, is, you know, when you are in the civilian community, you get a jury summons, and whether they randomly pull it numbers off of driver's license, voter rolls, household names, however it comes, it's a random pull, and you get pulled in, you get a juror number, and then you randomly get pulled out of that veneer to go to a particular courtroom, and it's all just this random hodgepodge of cooks, bakers, and candlestick makers. And in a military court, when what they call a convening authority, and that's a commander who makes the decision to send a service member to a court-martial, when that decision is made, that same person who is making the decision to send a soldier or a service member to a special court-martial or a general court-martial, when that decision is made, that exact same person hand-selects the jury from that person's own command. So if you're the commanding officer of a division and you make a decision that one of your soldiers needs to go to a court-martial, you then are going to hand-select a jury from that same division that's under your charge to decide whether that soldier is guilty or not guilty of the offense of which you believe he committed, or you wouldn't have sent him to the court-martial to begin with.
So not only is essentially the prosecutor picking the jury, but also these are people who are under the direct command of essentially the person deciding to prosecute.
That's exactly right. So they already know that this commander who they ultimately work under has made a decision to send a service member to a trial. They're getting selected to serve and decide whether the person's actually guilty or not guilty. So there's a very interesting and novel concept in military law that's not present in civilian jurisdictions called unlawful command influence. And it's there's books written about it. It's too much to talk about here, but the courts recognize that this can be an issue, that commanders can influence jurors, commanders can influence witnesses, commanders can influence charging decisions, commanders can influence prosecutors, and the appellate courts can be and sometimes are paternalistic in protecting the accused from this unlawful command influence, but that's probably the biggest difference between the military and civilian jurisdictions is how a jury is selected. However, that said, I will tell you that I believe in general and at large, the jurors that are selected to preside or to listen to evidence and a court-martial take their responsibilities extraordinarily serious, and I think that they really do what they believe is right. And again, by and large, I think they discount or disregard, I should say, the fact that a commanding general or a commanding officer has sent someone to a court. I think they put aside the differences in rank and, you know, what people say, and they do the work that they are assigned to be jurors in a case or to be members in a court-martial and follow the instructions that are given to them by the judge.
Well, Phil, thank you so much for spending your time with us today and sharing your great stories and all the tremendous work you do for clients all over the country and all over the world. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Scott. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.